Good evening from the stage of Sissel Recital Hall at Montana State University, Billings. Everyone is on stage tonight because we're having an informal community conversation about journalism, about the news, objectivity, fairness, and balance in the news. As we have said on the air for the last few days, we have invited the Ombudsman of National Public Radio, Jeffrey Dvorkin, to come and participate in this discussion tonight. And with him on stage, along with a number of members from our community and our region, with Jeffrey on stage tonight is Tom Kotinski, associate editor and a columnist for the Great Falls Tribune. Tom will be reacting to Jeffrey's remarks and open to your comments tonight from the audience. Jackie Yamanaka is the news director of Yellowstone Public Radio. And she says that she is a target also for your remarks tonight if you wish to make them or to ask her questions. Bruce Wittenberg is the former publisher of the Billings Gazette and of the Helena Independent Record. And Tom, Jackie, and Bruce are all here to speak from their experience either in the radio news business or the newspaper news business to the general subject that we're talking about tonight. We have about 50 members of the community on stage tonight that will be having their say along in the course of this program. And I want to welcome Jeffrey Dvorkin, who is leading our discussion tonight. Jeffrey has about three decades of experience in journalism, mostly radio-related journalism, and most of it in our neighboring nation to the north, or as one of my friends referred to it a few weeks ago, as our largest state, which is not kind, but I think most Canadians know what that means. Jeffrey has degrees from the University of Alberta, from the University of Toronto, and from the London School of Economics, and I'm just delighted to have him here. He is the official listener at NPR for what listeners have to say about NPR news coverage. And I'm delighted to have you launch this tonight, Jeffrey, and to participate, and look forward to the whole evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marvin. I'm delighted to be here. I was saying a few minutes ago that I've only been in Montana once before. I was 10, and my father took the wrong turn trying to get back to Alberta from Lake Chelan, Washington, and we ended up going through Montana, and I just remember him saying, well, in rather strong words, how could he have missed it? But it was a wonderful. I recall it as being quite beautiful at that time. But I believe both Montana and I have changed in the intervening years a little bit. Anyway, I've been ombudsman at National Public Radio for all of 9 months. After more than 15 years as a news manager, in the last 3 years, more than 3 years. As vice president of news at NPR, and then suddenly as one listener berated me when I took this job that I'd become I was the fox guarding the hen house, then how is it possible that someone who had been a manager in news and at NPR News could suddenly then become an advocate for the listener? And it a fair comment, I thought, because it is a little bit of a switch. It's looking at the world from the other side of my life, and to understand the issues and concerns from the perspective of the listener. I think that public radio, in my time at the CBC in Canada and as VP of News at NPR, the goal was always to keep the listener in mind. But this is a different approach, and I found it challenging, demanding, but always encouraging, because, and here I'll flatter you to a certain extent, the listeners are pretty smart. We have a very committed and interested group of people who are involved in the news, and as I've said in a kind of a quippy sort of way, my goal is to keep the public in National Public Radio, and it's nice to be able to not to be defensive anymore. I don't have to go into the newsroom and say, how are we going to defend ourselves against these accusations of bias? I can go in there and say, here's an accusation that we're biased in a certain way, or that we fail to cover the news in a certain way, or that we've missed a story entirely. And how do you, the journalists and the managers, respond? Because the aim isn't for me to respond. If I were to respond initially to all of the queries and critiques, I think that would be a kind of an expression of public relations, and that's really not what I'm doing. I'm trying to place a level of accountability on the shoulders of the senior managers and senior journalists at NPR. And it's unusual for them because, as I think my colleagues on this panel tonight will attest, journalists are a very defensive lot. And to try to bring them out of that defensive crouch is often very difficult. We're so beleaguered and we have such a tough time, and the listeners and the readers and the viewers don't understand us, and it's all sort of has a sort of semi-therapeutic quality. But in fact, this is a really good thing to do, to be able to bring that level of accountability to the journalists and to be able to make our journalism better. And in a number of instances in the last few months, I think it's been the listeners and me acting as their agent that has changed the direction of NPR's coverage in a couple of ways. Specifically, we can talk about this a little bit more, on the issue of the third parties that were running in this campaign. NPR, I think, started off by being very much attuned to the two major parties and basically ignoring certainly Nader and to a certain extent Buchanan, Hagelin, and Brown. And as I started receiving letters and phone calls, but mostly emails, because this really is an email phenom, it became quite evident that NPR was missing a big story here. So I write a column every 10 days or so on the NPR website where I berated my colleagues for this. And in their defensive crouch, they immediately started covering Nader and Buchanan specifically in different ways and decided that they would put stump speeches on All Things Considered every Wednesday afternoon, and that there would be a long 8 to 10 minute interview with one of the leaders or of the parties on Morning Edition, and this changed the tenor of the coverage. And I think that's one example where the input from the listeners actually penetrated the carapace of defensiveness at NPR and allowed NPR to do a better job. So I think that's one way where it happens. And I'd be interested in hearing your sense as well, both from a public radio perspective and from the perspective of the newspapers, about how are we doing? Are we reflecting the issues and concerns of your community effectively and fairly? And I'd be interested to start off by hearing from some of the other people here on the panel.
I think I'm going to take the opportunity, Marvin, and jump in and just say that when you talk about public radio as a system, there are local stations and there's NPR, for example. And Jeffrey, when you were vice president of news, he also heard from station newsrooms and news directors. And we also were upset about the way sometimes National Public Radio was covering news and how they were assigning reporters and so forth. And I speak this from having served on, it's called Public Radio News Directors Incorporated, having served on the board. And I want to give Jeffrey credit, because what he did is he created the bureau system where National Public Radio is not completely Washington-based. There are now editors, the editorial side, based all across the country. And they serve as a way for stations to communicate with NPR. Because you have to remember that we are not one cohesive unit. It's public radio, the system is like trying to herd cats, as a cliche goes. We don't all march to the same beat. We all have very different audiences, we have different issues, we have different concerns. And so we are not all the same.
Well, it was interesting to come to NPR and see that there are all these stations out there with very little contact with NPR. That NPR sort of had a kind of a very much a closed shop mentality. So I just decided that we'd figure out a better way of making sure that other voices got on the radio, so that we hear stories from, hear a lot of stories from Montana these days. But also from small and medium-sized towns that rarely were heard on the public radio system. So you now hear about 20% of all the stories now are done from the member stations, whereas a few years ago I think it was fewer than 5%. So that's worked out pretty well. But what about the perspective from the newspapers? What? Tom, what are you thinking?
Regarding public radio?
But regarding the public and the public's access to what you do.
Well, this is still Montana, and we're a small community. The whole state's a small community. In fact, I kind of look at it. I can look at any paper in the state, and I think most of you here can do this, and you can read the obit columns. And you know somebody, a survivor. And I think that's indicative of the fact that you have pretty good access to us. We're very visible members of the community. Whether we reflect your point of view, I'm not really sure. We've sure been trying to go out. Here's the defense that's coming out in me. Trying to go out and solicit the readers' input so that we know how to shape our news and feature reports. We have things like readers' panels, teen and adult panels. We do a lot of interactives. We poll. We have bureaus throughout the state. We use correspondence. We try to stay in touch. But yet, I regularly hear that we're slanted. We're too Republican. We're too Democrat, too liberal, too conservative. And I think you're actually getting a better report now than you've ever gotten before because of the reporters are better educated. And there's more resources at their fingertips, but I think that there is a perception out there that we're not doing our job and we've got an agenda. And I've got a couple theories on that, but I'll save those for later.
Well, I think the I'd like to I think add to what Tom and Jackie have said. In communities like Billings and Great Falls, we like to think of ourselves, I think, as community newspapers or community radio stations. And I think there's a little different responsibility there. There's no less responsibility to be fair and objective and so forth. But I think we also have a responsibility to our communities. The folks that we write about and the folks who read our newspapers or who listen to our radio station are the same folks we go to church with or we see at school. And so it makes it a little bit more difficult when you're covering these folks or writing about the things that they care about. But we do have a responsibility, in my view, to be, boosters of our community. And that sometimes tests your ability to be fair and accurate and unbiased and so forth, because the things you're writing about are the things that you really care about. And that just makes it more challenging probably for journalists in community situations than maybe it does at a national level.
Bruce, it's an interesting point because a few years ago at a meeting of the Association of Newspaper Editors of America, the editor of the Kansas City Star summed up his idea of what makes a good local newspaper. And I've never forgotten it. He said that a newspaper has to reflect a slightly better view of a community than actually exists, mm-hmm. because it allows people to have a positive sense of themselves. It's their better side that's shown in a newspaper, or in a public radio station for that matter, as opposed to kind of tabloid or, a police blotter. And I thought that this was a really wonderful expression of what a community newspaper does. It doesn't distort, it isn't biased, but it takes the best aspects along with the normal horribleness of that occurs in all communities, but basically presents an image of a town or of a community in a really positive way, so that people can feel comfortable with that view. I'd be interested in hearing from the folks here tonight whether you think that we as journalists are doing a reasonable job for you, because that's what who we're doing it for.
Does anyone want to comment on whether whether in the process of protecting the community's image there isn't perhaps too little hard investigative journalism? That's the other side of it. What if you really dig deep into the community and find things that people don't want to hear and don't want to read? Is there a conflict there? You don't have to answer that question. You can talk about anything you want. Does anyone want to comment?
It's very... Well, please.
Yes. My name is Don Roberts. I live here in Billings. There's an incident that happened recently in Miles City where a young 18-year-old girl passed away because of methamphetamine. She had a heart attack, and they brought her to Billings. A couple weeks ago, the Billings Gazette did an article where they followed through what was happening with a lot of these methamphetamine cases that were going before judges and how many of them were let off. And I think it kind of shows we should have more of a follow-up on some of these issues, because they do have deep significance. When somebody's selling these kind of drugs, they have real intent to cause great harm to a lot of people, even though it's for profit, ultimately causes great harm. And I think that the papers have to keep on top of those kind of things.
Do you feel, Mr. Roberts, that sometimes the media goes too far in pushing these stories? Do you ever get a sense that that we show no, you know, that the sense of gotcha journalism, as it's called, permeates too much, and that we've lost a kind of perspective about how to do these things?
I think since Watergate, people are more in an attitude of trying to get the gotcha, but I think if you have the facts and present it in such a way that it tends to be well-balanced, I think you kind of overcome that situation.
NPR did a story in the middle of the election campaign, which was a documentary on death row in Texas. I don't know if some of you, I see some people nodding around who may have heard it. It was one of the most extraordinary documentaries about the effect of working on death row. And it was the voices of the people, the men and women who run the system in Huntsville, Texas. It was extremely powerful. These were all people, except for one, who felt that they were doing a job that they needed to do, and one person who had decided that he just couldn't do it anymore and went off to become a carpenter. And it was an extraordinary documentary. It was very, very powerful. And to hear the voices of people who do these things, hundreds of them over a career. NPR came in for a tremendous amount of criticism for running a documentary on the death penalty in Texas when Governor Bush is running for president. And they felt that this was an example of NPR's clear anti-Republican bias.
We heard that here, Jeffrey.
And I think that there may have been a point to that. I mean, the situation was that this documentary was commissioned before Governor Bush got the nomination. But the question was, did it need to be run in the middle of a campaign? There are political consequences to running this. And I think that really is a good point. As powerful as the documentary was, should it have been run in the middle of a campaign? So we often, I think, don't appreciate or think enough about the consequences of our journalism. The journalism, in fact, may be right in as far as it's a good thing to report on, but there are ripples that happen in the result of that.
My name is Terry Havener, and I live here in Billings. And I don't know NPR's motive for, you know, I'm not going to judge that motive for running a story like that. but I did some research before I came here. And Gary Graham and Ricky Ray Rector were two people. One was from Arkansas and one was from Texas, and they both committed murder, and I'm sure you're familiar with those too. Well, the networks gave 30 stories to the Texas case and two to the Arkansas case, which was in 1992. So whereas your motives may be pure, when I as a consumer see this kind of thing, what am I to think? Because I have no way to know your motive, but all I see is this way lopsided story about Texas because of the political things that are going on there with Governor Bush. And the same time Bill Clinton left the campaign trail to go preside over this execution in Arkansas, two stories. So you can understand why I would think that, hey, I'm just getting one side of the picture here because of extreme bias. And that's what it appears to be. I don't know what else you would call it.
And I think you raise a very good point. I think one of the issues at NPR is that if there's a bias at NPR, and I think there's a bias in all journalistic organizations, it's a question of being able to address them in a way that's going to help the situation. My sense of the bias at NPR is that it's not as much political as it is cultural. NPR is overwhelmingly based in large cities on the two coasts, and the cultural values of people who live in large cities on the coasts are different than in many other parts of the country. One of the reasons that I created this, as Vice President of News, the system of bureau chiefs around the country and outside of the major cities was in order to get those other voices and those other sensibilities and qualities, which will correct that balance, I think. But yes, I think there is a kind of a cultural predisposition to certain kinds of stories. Obviously has a political consequence. I think what's important for what I do now is to help frame the discussion about what are the consequences of doing a story. To do a story on the death penalty, I think, is entirely legitimate. To do it in the middle of a political campaign and focusing on Texas has implications, and I think journalists can say, no, it doesn't. It's just pure journalism. That's nonsense. There's no such thing. So I appreciate your comment.
Years ago, when Susan Stamberg was a co-host of All Things Considered, there was a story about the Navy wanting to plant a huge antenna underground in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And Susan, bless her heart, who hasn't spent a lot of time outside of Washington, D.C. and New York, I mean, it's just a fact of life. She's not spent a lot of time out in the middle and western part of the country, said to a person on the air she was talking to on the phone from northern Michigan, she said, "What is the problem since hardly anyone lives up there?" That was perceived by the people in sparsely populated northern Michigan as being extremely insensitive, although relatively accurate. So, I mean, it is a lot of perception. And if Susan had traveled in northern Michigan, which happens to be my home state, if Susan had traveled there, she probably wouldn't have said that, because she would have realized that there are other very good things about northern Michigan, just as there are about northern Montana, northern Minnesota, and Wisconsin. But she hadn't spent time there, and she was not sensitive to that, and it was a kind of a dumb thing to say, but given her background, probably not strange. Do you deliberately send your anchors out into the real world, Jeffrey, on a regular basis, whether they want to go or not?
All things considered, does assign its hosts to stories outside. Bob Edwards is not a traveling kind of guy, so
he's been here.
He has been here, but he doesn't go out and do stories in the way that the others do. So I think it is a It's very important that the issues and the stories and the concerns of people in other parts of the country get heard, and I think that's happening more than it has in the past.
Hi, my name is Dan Zerker. I live in Billings. And this is more of a question to Mr. Dworkin than some sort of a statement, but I am a student of politics, and particularly what are sometimes arrogantly known as third world politics, but politics outside of the United States. I think the United States is arguably one of the most parochial countries in the world. We really don't look outward. We are, for the most part, unaware there's a major election in Canada going on right now. And in fact, I dare say very few Americans would have the slightest idea who the major candidates are, including the name of the prime minister, although I would be flabbergasted to find very many Canadians who did not know the minute details of our election. And this is just a question. A gentleman here mentioned that we are consumers, and the discussion so far has really been focused on sensitivity to local communities. But at one point or another, there's the danger of pandering, almost pandering, to the parochialism of the United States. NPR does an excellent job, when it can, of providing stories about things that most Americans find either uninteresting, at least initially, or unpleasant, stories about small countries struggling to survive in the world. And I'm just curious, do you receive a lot of negative comments from the publics in the United States when NPR, for instance, does a series on Africa or a series on, let's say, South America?
Quite the contrary. Every time we do stories like that, we receive a lot of encouragement. About 40% of all the stories on NPR are foreign stories. And it's clearly something that the listeners find interesting and valuable. I think that you raise an interesting point about the parochialism of news, and I don't think this is an American affliction particularly. I think it happens in many countries, and it's very hard to get people to in newsrooms to think more globally. And as newsrooms, and I'd be interested in hearing the thoughts of our colleagues in print, as news organizations become more committed to bottom line issues and making sufficient returns for their investors, newsrooms are increasingly being eviscerated from their resource base. There are fewer and fewer reporters, fewer and fewer editors in many news organizations. In the middle of the Lewinsky business, a year and a half ago, I was talking to the bureau chief on Capitol Hill for a newspaper. He was the Midwest bureau chief on Capitol Hill, and he was. 2 years ago, he had 12 reporters, and in the middle of the impeachment story, he had four. And I said, "Well, how do you cover the non-Lewinsky stories?" And he said, "I can't." And there were a series of stories about the kinds of legislation that were being passed in Congress while the attention was being shifted over to impeachment. Things like removal of the creation of easements for logging on government land, the elimination of easements for oil exploration on government land. All of those things had been removed while everybody's attention was being directed in other places. And he was saying that, you know, there were a huge number of farming stories that he wanted to do, but since his newspapers back in Iowa and Illinois wanted the main story of the day, he gave them the one story that was important instead of, or important in a sense, but the real story was changing market prices for potash and for canola oil and things that were really important for his agricultural economy that he couldn't do. Instead, he was just reduced to doing the scandal du jour, and he was very upset about that. So I think that as news organizations become more constrained, it causes a real problem for news organizations.
Could Tom and Bruce maybe respond?
No, I can respond for the Great Falls Tribune and probably most other Montana newspapers. We are local newspapers, and we make no apologies for covering local news. This is what people buy us for. You know, if we started to turn over that local space to the national news, and boy, we get reams of it on our wire. I mean, way more than you'll see in any news magazine on in any given week. We would quickly lose our readers, and we just absolutely must cover the local news. The way we try to become less parochial, as you would put it, is by localizing the international and national breaking stories. And we really make our mark at how well we do that. And I think that if you're being taking a critical look at your local newspaper, judge them on that, because that will make people locally very interested in what's going on nationally or internationally if they see a local tie. And there is always a local tie of some sort.
I would absolutely agree with what Tom said. The fact is there are more sources for news and information from all around the world than ever before. You know, we can all remember the days when there were one or two newspapers in town, three TV stations, a couple radio stations, that's about it. Well, think of the sources that you have now. And I think it becomes more and more important for local newspapers and other media to become more and more sharply focused on the local community. That's what the franchise is for local publications like that. The budget constraint issue, I think, is a real issue. And sometimes it has to do with the things you can cover, the volume or the different kinds of stories you can cover. But it also has to do with the quality of the stories that you produce, the ability to do quality editing, the ability to do better fact-checking, or maybe get one more source for a story, I think are all impacted by the things that are dealt with every day in newspapers and paying attention to budget issues.
It's interesting when the word community or local is used, because when I think local, when I think community, while I'm based here in Billings, to me, Lewistown is local. Riverton, Wyoming, even though it's out of our coverage area, is local. Lame Deer is local. My idea of community is much broader. And even though we are in Montana, we might as well be a bunch of different states, a bunch of different countries. Sometimes when I show up at events, I joke and say, oh, the big bad Billings media just rolled into town, and we're going to take over the coverage or something. From, you know, the local paper sort of look at me and, what are you doing here? I had a discussion not too long ago with a former public official, and he said to me, why do you travel so much? Why don't you just use the telephone? It's because I want to see people face to face. I want to see where you eat lunch. I want to see where you live. I want to drive the wrong way down the one-way streets in Great Falls. I want to get a sense of your community, because to those of you in Havre or Lewistown, we are your local public radio station. And I do make an effort, and sometimes I feel bad because I'm based here in Billings, the largest city in this region, and I'm not at the local school board meetings. I'm not at the local government meetings. And it's difficult.
We have choices.
I'm a one-person newsroom, and I have to make choices, and sometimes those choices are very difficult.
Years ago, knowing that we had a small budget, and knowing also, I think Jackie would confirm this from the Public Radio News Directors Association, when people are asked what they most want from public radio, They most want NPR, and they most want us to be a window on the world, especially in rural areas, because they see us as a sole source of a lot of world news and a lot of in-depth news about our own country that other media simply don't cover. So Jackie, in a sense, has had to live for years being an excellent co-host with Bob Edwards on Morning Edition. She's had to think in terms of our complementing the network. We cover the kinds of stories that NPR covers in terms of not subject matter so much, but public policy issues. The big questions, not the little local questions, the big questions, because it's compatible with the window on the world concept. Some urban stations have found over the years when they have done more and more local news and they've done focus groups or studies, people have said, we want to hear more of Morning Edition and less of you. And we've kept that in mind here. So we try to complement NPR in what we do, but we still get some criticism that we have too much local input and not enough national and world news. A lot of rural stations around the country have that same reaction. A gentleman here has a question.
Well, my name is Jock Michelotti, and I'm a former school board member. And so a lot of what you're talking about is of interest to me. Because you've talked about community, you've talked about profitability, you've talked about the ability to cover. What was interesting for me was serving on a school board, and for example, Bruce's publication always had a reporter there. That reporter knew the ins and outs of our district a lot better than people might imagine. And what always struck me as interesting is for as much as he knew, and how much they could tell and inform the public, it didn't seem like that message gets out to the public quite as much. And my sense is that there might be a couple reasons for that. One, maybe is the concern about the community and drawing that line, and you're close to those people that you're covering that may be on both sides of the issue, which make it extremely difficult to bring some of that out, and yet there's a public need to hear that. And then the other thing that I've heard from those conversations with the journalists is that there's also the profitability side of this thing, and to get into an issue in depth, that's a very difficult thing to do, and so as a result, that short circuits as well. So I guess my question is I'd like to hear a comment, because as a former person who had that contact, it has frustrated me over the years to not see the type of coverage that maybe the public might have an interest in hearing a little bit more about that they don't hear about.
And maybe even bad news. One of the comments that I hear sometimes about the Gazette reporting on School District 2 is they don't want to hurt the next mill levy. And if they're too critical, people will vote against increasing school funds. Bruce, you want to take that on?
I think that's given the Gazette way too much credit for being thoughtful about this stuff. I mean, there just isn't that kind of conspiracy, you know, to taint the news. I think, you know, decisions are made every day in newspapers and in newsrooms. How much do readers really want to know about what happened at the school board meeting last night? Sometimes the decisions have to do with how much space can we allow for a story on school district to his board meeting, and some of it is how much are they really going to read? You know, if we do a 60-inch story, how many people are going to make it to the end of that story? So, you know, I think in fairness, it you know, every story that goes into a newspaper every day, or every story I'm sure that goes on the air, somebody made a decision about the story showing up at all, how much detail should be in there, and so forth. There are folks with real specific interest. You know, sports is the best example of how difficult it is to put a newspaper together every day. Folks that are interested in sports coverage tend to be intensely interested in a very few things. People that are interested in the function of a school district beyond how well my son is educated in the school district tend to be a very small group of people with a very intense interest, I think. And so you make those decisions based on, you know, how many readers is this going to affect, and you know, you kind of get stuck in trying to be all things to all people, I think, sometimes. But it's really, you know, it's just human beings making decisions that they believe are right for the larger majority of readers.
Tom, you want to comment on that same?
Well, I just wondered, there's one heck of a lot more to be lost for a newspaper in not covering something. I mean, our job is to cover things. And by backing off of an issue, particularly if there's a great public interest in it, that's not a wise decision on any level at all. The other thing that, you know, we are subject to pressure from the public, particularly in the area of coverage. And if there are enough people who are saying, by God, this is what we want covered, we cover it. It's not, it really doesn't work so much as we're not out there looking not to cover something. That's a discussion that never occurs in a newsroom. It's more, as Bruce said, a discussion of how you allocate your resources. But if it has great public interest, it gets covered.
Yeah, I guess I would address the Billings Gazette on this. But a few years ago, during the time when they wanted to, the city wanted to, and the county, I guess, wanted to collect property taxes from people, the front page of the Gazette was a tax collector going to an auto dealership collecting $130 worth of taxes or something like that. I felt about that story that I mean, it's one thing to report on that the county's doing this, collecting taxes. Okay, that's a story. They're going all out for it. But in order for a story like that to happen, either the tax collection agency contacted the Gazette, or the Gazette contacted the tax collection agency, excuse me, and it was set up in order to create a story that was otherwise just, you know, I mean, why do something like that? It to me, I perceived it as the county or the state, whichever agency it was, I don't remember now, using the media to scare people. And so at that point, that's when I stopped my subscription to the Billings Gazette. I figured, you know, if because I felt it was an abuse of their right of the free press. It was an abuse of it. It wasn't, you know. Mm-hmm. More recently, this happened on a TV station, which nobody here is representing them, when they had their big roundup for people with outstanding warrants. Well, a gal, young gal, sweetest person you'd ever want to know, was paying some fines, and apparently they had some outstanding, and they saw this going on the news, on the TV. So they called the police station, said, well, we'll come down and pay it, okay? The next thing they know, the police and one of the local TV stations are there photographing them arresting this poor girl. That's an abuse. That's not a privilege or a right that anybody has. That's an abuse of a freedom. And it's things like that would make me stop buying the Gazette. I have plenty of other news sources. I don't need the Gazette. It would make me stop listening to TV stations and their local news because I have other news sources. I can still get news, and I can get it maybe on a more even-handed basis. But those kinds of things upset me because that's an abuse of a right. It's really a pretty dangerous area, I think.
You raise a very interesting point, which is you know, the right to privacy and the right to, and when that comes into conflict with the First Amendment. A lot of journalists feel that they have a right to film something or videotape something or report on something, regardless of the effect that it has on people's privacy. There is no constitutional right to privacy, but there certainly is a a constitutional right to freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and it's a conflict that we as journalists have to look very carefully at. One of the things that I'm going to be doing over the next few months is to try to codify some kinds of standards and practices for NPR journalists, which has never been done before, and it makes me awfully damn nervous, the idea that I'm putting down something that is going to have a kind of almost like a legal and enforceable quality. But I think it's very important that standards be set. One can argue them all the time, and I suppose rewrite them just as easily as they get written in the first place. But I think it's very important that that we as journalists be held to a standard by ourselves, by our bosses, and by you, so that you can point to standards and practices guide and say, you know, you weren't even accountable to your own standards. And I think that becomes a very important value for us. So I think that, and one of the issues that we're going to have to address is how to balance the public's right to know with an individual's right to privacy. There isn't an easy answer.
Bruce, you want to comment since that question was addressed to the newspaper?
Well, I can't speak specifically to either one of the issues, but I can't disagree with anything that was said. I think that sometimes mistakes are made, and sometimes the newspaper might be put in situations that are uncomfortable or come out somehow to create the kind of perceptions you described. So, again, I think it's something that we try and identify and deal with every day and sometimes make unfortunate decisions.
Jim Reno, County Commissioner, and I have to tell you, I have a huge respect for the media. I have yet to have any cause of concern that they've done something that was self-serving. I just haven't experienced it. But I do have a question that I was hoping I could bring tonight, and you could solve this for me. And that is, those of us that's in public life, when do we call and share some information when a reporter wasn't there, and when do we not? For example, last week we were served with a notice that some action that the county commissioners took on a pending gravel pit is going to end up in a court challenge. And I took the liberty, because two of the reporters I know in the past that have had an interest in that wasn't there, that I emailed them and said, hey, we've been served. You'd like a copy of it? Come on over. But as I do that, one would think, well, gee, I have the same responsibility to share the bad news as well as the good news. And when I begin to do that, when am I kind of determining what's going to be printed and what isn't? Because I didn't pick up the phone and call you on this story, but I picked up the phone on the other story. Am I beginning to enter into an uncomfortable arrangement where I'm not being totally honest with myself or you folks when I sensed there was a reason to call, or maybe I didn't think I should have called and you folks thought I should have? Not much of a question, but
I think it's
with that quite a bit.
Bruce, you have a thought?
Oh, I'd say if there's ever any doubt, call. You know, I think part of, the relationship between public officials and the media, especially in communities like ours, is a lot about relationships and a lot about trust. Knowing that we can talk to each other on certain issues, knowing that we're not going to play games with each other on making the decisions about when to call and not to call. So I think being open and honest and making the call, talking to the reporter, and is always the best way to go.
Jackie, how do you respond to someone calling you with information from a public official's office as opposed to sending you information and giving you the complete choice? Do you feel put upon in any way when people call you?
No. I mean, one of the things that we do as reporters, editors, is we're gatekeepers, is what it is, and there are many factors that go into the decision of what goes in the next newscast or what goes into the next paper. Some of that has to be, is it a slow news day or big event coming? How are we doing on time, et cetera, how complicated the issue may be. I mean, these are just a few examples that come off the top of my head. And I'd much rather get the call. And a lot of times when people just call, they just want to talk a little bit. And sometimes they just say, I'm not calling you on a story, but I'm just giving you some background information. You know, this is not for publication. It's just for your information. Or they heard a story that I did that was on that morning, and they wanted to provide another perspective or another viewpoint. And I'm always welcome to that, but that doesn't mean that I will always turn on the tape machine or, you know, start another story. I was thinking, Jim, that obviously you're not in Helena because, boy, the phone is just ringing constantly with various tips on some agencies actually calling on another agency or so forth. I think, you know, you should never be afraid to call, but as Bruce said, a lot of it has to do with relationships and trust, frankly, that when you tell, when you're talking to a reporter, even after, you know, during your kid's ball game, that, you know, what we're talking about right now is between us. Do you see what I mean? Or, you know, when you're calling on official business. Because, frankly, we expect that public officials or organizations are going to call us with the good news. And that we're going to have to work harder to uncover the things that maybe you don't want us. You know, not necessarily bad news, but things that perhaps are not as flattering. I don't know if that answers your question.
My follow-up question would be, Ajit, if you called me on the good news, why didn't you call me on the bad news? So there goes a relationship.
No.
I don't think I started off as a City Hall reporter in Montreal, and I quickly discovered that there was only good news to come, and that when things were not so good, then I had to work a little harder to find that, and that's fine. I think one of the things that, as a recovering City Hall reporter, I had to find out was that the public really got suspicious when reporters were too cozy with their sources, and I think that there's an ongoing relationship. As a City Hall reporter, I'd see city councilors every day and chat with them in the halls and then do a story. But I didn't have any expectations that I could really depend on them, and they shouldn't have had any expectations that I was going to do them any real favors. It was a more professional relationship than that. It didn't mean that I didn't like a lot of them, or that I respected a number of them, or I disrespected a number of them, and vice versa. You just had to understand that there were that a level of coziness was not good for either the elected official or for the journalist.
We have a gentleman over here.
Yes, good evening. My name is Jerry Juleson, and I come from a remote ranch out here about an hour and a half west of Billings. And if you'll bear with me, my communication skills with horses are much better than with people, and I'm having a little difficulty here. But basically, I'm very appreciative of the opportunity, since National Public Radio is my main source of contact with the world. I get mail three times a week, and so the newspapers are pretty well out. I don't have a TV for a very good reason. I don't feel that it's things that I want to see most of the time. But I do listen extensively to National Public Radio. And I've called Marvin on the issue of the timing of the incident with the death row thing, and I hope I haven't chided him too harshly on that. But anyway, the reason I'm here tonight was on the objective and fairness and the issues that you covered earlier, and I was glad to hear some of the things that you said, because I feel sometimes sort of disenfranchised with my somewhat traditional and conservative views. And one of the things that brought me here specifically this evening is an incident that I heard yesterday morning on public radio. It was during the morning newscast, which I usually get between 7 and 8 p.m., and it was on the regional news. And it came out of Boise, and there was a woman by the name of Jill Hoyt that did a little piece on the release of the 25 grizzly bears in the wilderness area that's proposed for that area of Idaho. Well, I was somewhat astounded during the brief resume that she gave, which was a compilation of, I think, some words from the governor and some from the Forest Service, and then her own editorial on some of it. And on her own part, she interjected something about uninhabited wilderness that the bears would be released in. And I was quite curious, and later that morning, I was able to talk to her personally, and I was very grateful that she kindly answered my phone call, and we had a nice discussion. I think she's probably a very nice lady. And her reasoning behind the uninhabited wilderness terminology was that she was in time constraints and felt that that best described the situation. Well, I was somewhat surprised to see that she hadn't really researched the fact that the uninhabited wilderness that she was talking about, which I verified later, incidentally, through the offices of Larry Craig, who's the senator from Idaho, contains a number of ranches and a number of homes, as well as other private holdings within the wilderness area. And indeed, the release will take place in a wilderness area, but it is far from uninhabited. And this is just an example of the things that sometimes I find on public radio that kind of shocked me with my upbringing, which was in that of a native Montana, born and raised up on the High Line, and sometimes feel like the world is passing me by here. But I am concerned definitely with the objectivity, and sometimes what I feel is maybe described as a little bit of elitism that I get from the radio itself. But I'm very encouraged by the fact that you've addressed some of those issues already this evening, and I'm glad I attended, even though, as I indicated earlier, I'd been a lot more comfortable if you were all a corral full of wild horses than the people that you are here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Actually, pretty eloquent, I would say.
I agree.
Jeffrey?
Well, I would just quote Walter Lippmann, who described journalism as a refuge for the vaguely talented. So I think, we have feet of clay as well, and time constraints. I can't, I didn't hear the report, but I can tell you that I have also been under the gun on deadline, being pressured by an editor to finish off a story and get it on the radio. You hope you do a better job more days than not. And I'm sure this reporter will remember your phone call for a long, long time, and that she will make sure that she uses her time much better in the future so as to avoid being the recipient of another phone call. These points of contact are really very valuable, and I can't overstate just how significant they are in the professional lives of reporters. To get a call like that just brings you up sharply, and it has a salutary effect that lasts a lifetime in many cases. So I think it was a good thing you did.
Going back to Jackie's opening remarks, Jeffrey's probably responsible for the fact that it was an Idaho reporter who was on National Public Radio with that story. Excuse me.
My name is Tom Bennett. I live here in Billings. And my question is brought out by Mr. Reno's comments about occasionally feeding stories to the press, whether it's the written press, radio, or the TV, any of those. And my experience has been that the role of the media has been extremely focused upon not just simply educating or being a forum for open discussions, and focusing on, as the title of this program was supposed to be, the objectivity or the fairness or balance, but it has become a very powerful tool. The media is about the most powerful tool I've ever seen to affect public perceptions, because perceptions become reality in no time at all. That is, the spin doctors working back and forth now in Florida to, this could be a sociologist's dream, trying to say what's going on down there in Florida someday because of this constant spinning. And my worry about this is that in the pursuit of trying to make money for your investors, accountability can be lost, because your goal is to entertain. Your goal is to pull in people. And the tremendous power of the press can be misused many times. I'll ask later on in our program tonight about the effects in the court. But there are many times people will play off things in the court, recognizing that, whereas in the courtrooms, witness the O.J. Simpson trial, there are rules, there are laws, there are things that we're supposed to focus on and obey, and there are standards you can keep. In the press, there really are none. You set up a code of standards, but if you don't live up to your code of standards, what is the effect? What is the punishment? What will you propose for that?
Take your time, Jeffrey.
Well, there have been instances where reporters have been fired for sort of dereliction of duty or plagiarism or making it up. But if there is a standard that is set and maintained, and that there's a rigorous editorial process, and there's a lot of discussion about what those standards are and how they're applied, that tends to raise the bar for all of us. And I think that the concern that I have is that because we are so driven in our different journalistic lives, and the demands that are being put on us are so much, well, they've always been pretty intense. They seem to be getting more intense. There's less time to be thoughtful. And that's a real concern. That leads to a kind of a decline of standards. You see the proliferation, certainly on television, of these talk shows and some of the programs are vastly entertaining, but I'm not sure that they serve the same kind of public issues that they think they do. But it's a lot cheaper to have some glib person who can have a machine gun approach to broadcasting go on television and create a buzz or a spin, then have a newsroom full of editors and producers and researchers who are going to be able to contextually do news in a way that's appropriate. It's a different time. News organizations make a lot of money, but they make a lot of money because they tend to put on programming that gets huge audiences, and you don't get a huge return on your investment if you have a lot of editors and researchers sitting around trying to make sure that you've got it all correct. And I think this is the kind of tabloid mentality that has taken over, certainly in television news, that creates huge profits for the broadcasters, but I think has diminished the quality of the journalism.
We have about 55 minutes left in this program, and we have plenty of opportunities for folks from the community to speak. Bruce Wittenberg has to leave us in a few minutes for a family celebration, so I want to put this question to all four of our panelists to give us your personal reaction to the media that you listen to or watch or read other than your own publication or organization, what is your criticism of the media in general for news? Tom, you said you were just loaded for bear for this, well, so I'm going to give you the first chance to...
I don't know exactly loaded for bear. Looking at the other media, this is one of the things that, you know, the newspapers are their job is to not only to inform but also to entertain and to lead. In terms of newspaper, in terms of television stations, it appears that a lot is driven by the entertainment factor. Radio, there's a little bit of that. I'm a big radio listener. I love National Public Radio. I like Montana Public Radio. I listen to the University of Montana over on our end of the state, and I think they've got very high standards, and the news is quite good. They just don't have the time to do it in depth, and what they do is sort of transitory. It comes and it goes. Whereas the newspaper, it's a printed record, and for that reason, it seems to have a little bit more credibility. It's something you can pass around and look at. And, well, I don't know if I answered your question.
What about cable? You watch much cable news?
I don't have cable.
Okay, that answers that. Bruce Wittenberg, what is your reaction to the media?
Well, I've got all the good stuff, the satellite TV and internet and all that stuff. And frankly, I think the proliferation of electronic news has created a situation that's more about speed than accuracy. You know, the calling of elections, 5 minutes after the polls close is ridiculous. It's a guess. That's all it is a guess. And I think it's just wrong. And as we saw a week ago, it also can be a huge embarrassment. You know, as we saw, Florida was called early for Gore. And here we are 11 days later dealing with it. So I think the speed issue has really hurt accuracy and quality. Now, saying that, newspapers ought to wake up to what their role should be, because they can't play in that game. Although you did see plenty of examples of headlines that said Bush wins or whatever. So they do get caught up in it a little bit. But newspapers have an opportunity to really kind of provide some, be a little bit more patient, I guess, with the information that they're sharing, and hopefully as a result of that being a little bit more accurate. But I'm embarrassed by the speed that seems to be what the contest is all about now.
Bruce, I want to thank you for being here, and I know you have to leave, and I appreciate it. And let's hear a round of applause for Bruce Wittenberg. Okay, Jackie, what media other than public radio do you rely on, and what do you think of it?
I will have to admit, I don't consider public radio my main source of news and information. It is one of my sources. And I don't say that to be cruel in any way, to have Jeffrey Dvorkin sit here. And I think it's a responsibility of you as consumers to get your news from many different sources. I'm one of those people that probably drives everyone else at the station crazy, because NPR will be on, CNN is on, the internet is on, and I may be talking on the phone or sitting in front of my computer, another computer, with the AP wire just scrolling. And I'm paying attention to all of them. I know it's hard to believe. I do watch network news, the local news, as well as the main, when you think of ABC, CBS, and so forth, because I'm interested in what they're reporting on and how they're reporting on it. And sometimes, frankly, I come away from news conferences and I read or hear what my colleagues have put on the air, and I think, were we at the same event? And it causes me to question my own work sometimes. There are times when I work on stories that I know are going to air the next morning, and frankly, I can't sleep at night, because I think to myself, if I could only have made one more phone call, if only so-and-so, it's an agonizing profession in that way, because you're always wondering, if I only had one more minute, if I only had 30 seconds, because that's the reality of a newscast, for example. But some of my criticisms of my colleagues is I wish that they could give, and I'm talking just broadcast, more time. And I wish that they didn't have to think about things like ratings and try to entertain people, that they could just have a dialogue on public policy. But at the same time, I probably have bored many, many public radio listeners to death with political debates, town hall meetings, call-in shows, all politics, all the time.
That's our new format, by the way.
And so we're going to have Montana legislature from January 3rd to April 24th, roughly. But you try to balance these out, and I know it's difficult, but I feel for my colleagues that have, that run news 24 hours a day. They have that constant news hole they're trying to fill. And basically it's just update, update, update. And it's not telling us, why are we listening to this? What does this mean for me? To take a step back and provide some analysis. And I feel bad for them.
Jeffrey Dworkin, other than National Public Radio, what do you rely on for information, and what do you think of it?
Well, I'm kind of detoxing from news in a way. I don't feel that I need to be as connected now in this role. I know it sounds contradictory, but I don't need to be as plugged in now as I did when I was a news manager. So I've relieved myself of the burden. And it's allowed me to just look around a little bit and figure out whether it's, what works and what doesn't. And one of the things that I've always suspected this, and I'm even more convinced of it, that one of the great failures of the media is its reliance on polling. In one of the columns I wrote a few months ago, I suggested that NPR stop reporting polls. Well, the reaction in the newsroom was astonished, to say the least, and hostile, mostly. And I thought that it brought them out of their hiding holes, because it revealed to me just how much NPR people, many NPR people, love the idea of being part of the insider quality. And polls do that for journalists. It tends to give them a sense that they know something that others don't, when in fact they know nothing, or they know less than other people. Most polls are badly done. The sample size is too small. The question is often misleading. Most of them are what are called omnibus polls, which is you ask Procter & Gamble when they're doing a survey of, whether someone's going to buy Sunlight soap, would you mind tagging on at the end voter intention? It's a cheap way of doing a poll, but it's you're calling people who are at home in the middle of the day, so you're going to get pensioners and homemakers, you're not going to get a cross-section. There are about a dozen variables that are out there that people don't know about. And I mentioned this idea that, we should just stop reporting polls, because they deform rather than inform, and they don't really tell us anything. And one senior NPR journalist said, but what would we have to talk about? I said, well, shoe leather and reporting would be a really good way of doing it. And he said, oh, well, that's just anecdotal evidence. I said, anecdotal evidence is what we used to call reporting. So my bully pulpit is to get journalists to stop reporting polls. And I think that NPR has become tempted by this veneer of insiderness and omniscience And we saw that on election night when NPR started reporting exit polls. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Florida, people who were giving information to exit polls were the people who had thought they voted for Gore, but in fact had voted for Buchanan. So the exit polls were utterly meaningless. So I think that I feel even more righteous than I did before.
If you haven't gathered it already, you can understand how Jeffrey was more popular with the 600 member stations than he was with the senior reporting staff at NPR.
Hello, I'm Bill Kennedy, Yellowstone County Commissioner. The question that I have is, in your leading up to it, is the how difficult is it for the media to admit that there was a mistake? We, those of us that did stay up election night and watch the retractions, it was historic. Watching the national news actually say we made a mistake. We saw that with the trip this year. I think you folks had some letters to the editor and a controversy this year, and were duped over that. I think a lot of times we see in different newspapers that the story may be wrong. And we may see a retraction on the last page the next day. How difficult is it for the media actually to say, we made a mistake, and let's try to, not just we can do better next time, but how do we make it better after we had the splash in the on the news, on the 5 o'clock, on the 10 o'clock, on the next morning news?
Well, it's very difficult because our credibility is what we, you know, is our stock in trade. So the fact that we've made a mistake, we're very reluctant to admit that. And part of it is our own sense of how important we think we are, but I also think it's because the lawyers have had at us, and lawyers are very concerned that if we have made a mistake, to actually admit liability might open the way for a lawsuit. So as I was discussing the role of the ombudsman, I'm the only broadcasting ombudsman in the United States, and I was talking to a colleague at CBS, and he said, oh God, the lawyers would kill us if we ever created an ombudsman at CBS. And I think that's a real issue that they have to get over, because my sense is that the ombudsman is there to not to stop lawsuits. I think if we make a mistake and we libel someone, and we should, you know, be willing to take the consequences of that. We should be smart enough not to get into that situation. But I think that there's a real anxiety about, because this is such a litigious environment now, that has impeded the idea of running corrections. And NPR is not very good at it. We do not have a place on NPR where we can go on the air and say, that thing you heard yesterday, well, we were wrong. We don't have a mechanism to do that. I think we should, and I'm pushing very strongly to create some kind of programming mechanism where we come on in the same time of day 24 hours later and say, yesterday at this time we broadcast something, NPR regrets the error, or whatever the circumstances are. So we're nowhere near where I think we should be at this point.
Tom?
I think Montana newspapers are doing a much better job in owning up.
I agree.
than we did in the past. I know in years past, to get a correction in a newspaper was, you had to jump all kinds of hurdles and go through hoops to get it. We have a standing position in our paper that's in the same place every single day. It's on page 2. It's our national page. And it tells people in that space how to get a correction, and that space is filled almost every single day. which would indicate that that the corrections policy is a fairly liberal one. Now, I can tell you, as a person who does some reporting and who's made my share of mistakes, how embarrassing it is to make one, to have it called your attention, to investigate it, because you always investigate it. You don't just take somebody's word for it, and then to correct it. Because every day when you're writing something, you're holding it out. It's kind of like your dirty laundry out for 50,000 people to read every single day. And it hurts. You learn your lessons. But I think the people actually respect you a little bit more when you have a standard policy. Now, I think you're probably aware that in Montana, there are very specific laws governing libel for newspapers. And that you have to give a correction if you're wrong in approximately the same space, the same kind of headline, or your position in court is going to be a lot worse. So unlike the lawyering that goes on with broadcasting on a national level, here in Montana, if we've libeled somebody and we've determined that we've libeled somebody, we do everything we can to immediately get a correction out. I can give you an example. We inadvertently made a mistake at one point that was taken as a libel, and we found out about it before anybody brought it to our attention. And it was about 6 months later, just stumbling through another story on a follow-up. My God, we got it wrong. Well, we not only published a correction, but we also published it in a very prominent place, even more prominent than the original story because we felt so badly about it. We still got sued. We lost a suit, and we lost a dollar. So, does that answer your question? Yeah.
Gentleman over here.
Yes, three different kinds of media, two of which are here tonight. But I'm kind of a news junkie. I'm Gene Wade, and I'm in the financial services area, and so I'm watching the news and during the day. But some trends that I've noticed. A few years ago, the reporting was more or less just factual. Something happened. Recently, that seems to have changed, probably in the last 10 years. And the talk media, the NPR is an example, one of the things they're doing is they are taking reporters and they're interviewing the reporters and making the listener believe that they're experts in that area, when in fact they may have just flown into Florida to cover the current topic. And really don't have enough background. I mean, they should probably not be interviewing the reporter, but should be talking to the election officials, somebody who knows the law, knows the rules. Now, the print media does it a little bit differently. And I pick up it because I'm reading a lot of economic news, and I'll see an article that's written by an individual, and on the surface it looks fairly accurate, but as I get into it, I find a lot of glaring mistakes. At the bottom of the article, there's nothing that says what his credentials are. So what's happening now is that the media is starting to change public opinion because they're starting to ask these people questions about what they think should happen, or in the print media, economic information that's not accurate without their credentials. I'd like a comment on that.
Well, I think that there's a, you're right, that there's a tendency to create pundits where, in fact, reporters should not be pundits. Seems to me that there are three aspects to reporting. Well, one is fact-based reporting, one is analysis, and one is opinion. And the combination of the three gives a pretty good explanation of an ongoing story. The problems that we get into is when we start to confuse, when we haven't made it clear to the listener the differences between the two. So we suddenly ask a reporter to, well, what do you think will happen? And in fact, we should never take the reporter out of his or her reportorial role. And you see it on programs on the Sunday morning television talk shows where reporters come on and are encouraged to come up with wild scenarios because it's just more interesting. And when NPR reporters go on these programs, and they're a fact of the journalistic landscape now, we have told our reporters never to step away from your role as reporter, so that if on Fox News Sunday, which is, I think, the worst of the lot, Mara Liasson and Juan Williams are on there, and they say, well, Mara, guilty or not guilty? What do you think? Mara should not say, I think he's guilty. She should say, well, here's what I hear people saying. That should be her role. And we've kind of helped the reporters who go on these programs ensure that the quality of their reporting isn't compromised by being on these programs. It doesn't work all the time, but we try.
Maybe this is another factor involved in that. I'm Bob Stickney, a Billings resident. And ever since the Vietnam War was fought in our living rooms, courtesy of television, I think a growing factor is what I call compassion fatigue. And one thing that seems to take care of that is on the expressways, it's called a gaper's block. You know, people, when they see an ambulance, they'll slow down and look. You know, and I'm just wondering what kinds of things could be done by both print and radio to help people who maybe feel like they've got so much information that they don't know how the heck to deal with it.
Well, I think you raise a very important issue. The introduction of computers into newsrooms has changed the quality of the information that we're trying to process. My 25-cent theory on this is that when computers were brought into newsrooms so that they could process information more rapidly, it changed how editors handled information. In 1984 or 85, when computerization in newsrooms began, what would happen is, before that, there were reams of wire copy, and a so-called copy taster would come in at the beginning of his or her shift, go through the copy, rip it, put it in different piles, national, local, international, economics, and then hand it out as stories to be written or followed or whatever. And at the end of a day, you'd have a pile of wire copy on this newsprint, and you would file it, and it was just, you know, it was just huge. So when computers came in, this was great because you could process more information in a day than you could otherwise. And what would happen is that each story that came in would be numbered, and at the end of a day, you'd have about 400 or 500 stories in the computer. That was in 1984 or 1985. When I left the CBC in 1997, just out of curiosity, I looked at the number at the end of a 24-hour period. We're up to 7,000 a day. At the high point, at the high watermark of the Lewinsky story, I went into the newsroom and looked at the computers at noon on one day when something happened, I think the day that the impeachment was passed, at noon it was up to 11,000. And I think what's happened as newsrooms have become depopulated, and that editors are saying, my God, I've got to double my ratings or whatever. I think what has happened at a subconscious level is that news managers have said, we can't make any sense of the world anymore. I don't have the resources to cover the world in the way that we did a generation ago. I'm just going to go for the stories that are going to attract the biggest audiences. So it is a Monica Lewinsky story. It is an O.J. Simpson story. It is Dateline NBC and the tabloids and 60 Minutes and that sort of thing. Rather than say, I'm going to have a reporter who's going to deal with economic issues, or I'm going to have a reporter, I'm going to have a bureau in Africa, or I'm going to have a bureau in Asia. Those things have just been taken away from once glorious news organizations like CBS. They don't do that sort of thing anymore. But they do 60 Minutes and Barbara Walters and all that stuff.
Is it?
Daniel Shore does an incredible job of helping with this.
But Daniel Shore is one of, I mean, he's 81 years old. He went to work for CBS when Ed Murrow was in knee pants. You know, I mean, it's this really is another generation.
Yes, sir. I'm George Remington. I'm from Billings. I retired about 15 years ago after 35 years in the news business. As Bruce Wittenberg, I was publisher of the Billings Gazette and before that of the Helena Independent Record. You spoke of a cultural bias. I'd like to go back to that for a minute. And I think maybe that's what NPR should be. I think your clientele or your listenership are mostly very educated people.
Overeducated, some would say.
All right.
a lot smarter than I am.
But I think, as somebody pointed out a little while ago, there's also a lot of elitism in this business. And I was as guilty as anybody else. We tend to our friends tend to be our colleagues, or we get cozy with our news sources. The guy in the police beat gets cozy with the cops, and the guy covering City Hall gets cozy with the officials there. You cover a legislature, you get cozy with those guys. You probably, after the session's over, go out and have a beer with them every day. And so that is a problem. And I think we also tend to join organizations of like people, service clubs, private clubs, country clubs, and we don't really know what the public out there is thinking or what it wants. I had a reporter once in Helena who covered politics, and he joined a bowling league. And he said, I had no idea what the people out there were thinking, what they were talking about. And it changed his view of his job a whole lot. And I think maybe we do need to get out there with the hoi polloi a little bit more and find out what they're thinking, what they're talking about. Then maybe we'll write for them instead of our news sources.
I think that's a very interesting point, because one of the issues at NPR was that the length of the stories at NPR, I thought when I got there, was incredibly long. They didn't understand how people live their lives, especially in the morning. You know, you're shoving the oatmeal down the kids and trying to get them out of the door in time for school. They don't have time for a 13-minute story. What they do have time for is a 5 to 8 minute story. So we started cutting them down, but boy, the reporters and the producers squealed because we were chopping their children up. But in fact, it wasn't useful to the listener. And I think that understanding how people use the radio, understanding, you know, what people are thinking about, I think that that's incredibly important. And I think that if journalists are honest with themselves, you ask them, who are you doing this story for? You're saying, well, I'm doing it for, you know, my colleague sitting next to me here, really, rather than for the listener. And I want to try to get them to understand how their reports are being perceived.
One of the criticisms, Jeffrey, of the NPR News Department has been that it it stopped some years ago being an alternative news source and started thinking of itself as an electronic version of the Washington Post and the New York Times. Would you respond to that criticism? That's a criticism that I've heard more in the West than I have in the East.
I think it has become more mainstream in a way and less of an alternative. Let me take a couple of minutes here and give you an impression about what's happened to NPR over the last, say, 10 years or so. It really was a wonderful little campus radio outfit years ago. It had very few listeners. It was found inside the audiovisual building at a college. Everybody had leather patches on their jackets, and it was really, it was radio for us, by us, to us. When NPR went broke in 1983, we woke up one morning and we were $7 million in debt. The stations rescued NPR. They came back and they said, "You can't be trusted, to run this budget. We're gonna take over." And in fact, the customers, the stations, now own the company. The other thing that happened was is that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting said, "We're not going to give you another cent. We're going to give it all to the stations and let them give it to NPR." And that created a kind of a closer connection to the listener than existed before. So we became more populist because of that. And in 1991, after the Gulf War, where we were doing news that was different, our audience grew as a result of that. A number of things happened. I was still a lad back at the CBC in those days. But apparently, Neil Conan was captured by the Iraqis, held for a week. People started to notice the reporting that was done. It wasn't just taking press releases from the Defense Department. The audience went up. The third thing that happened was that when Newt Gingrich got a hold of Congress in 1994, and the first thing he said is, "Well, we're going to cut all government funding to public radio," PBS started lobbying furiously on the Hill. But NPR, under its president of the day, Del Lewis, said, "Well, you know what? Maybe we should wean ourselves from government money." And that, to that extent, those pledge drives that everybody loves so much actually became more functional, and more money came from the listeners to the stations to NPR, so that now less than 2% of NPR's money comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We are truly a private, not-for-profit company. So we are more popular, more rooted in the stations, and have a larger audience than we ever have. My guess is that after this election, the audience will go up again. What this means is that we are more mainstream, and we are less of an alternative. And that's the Faustian bargain that we've had to create. We could be like Pacifica, I suppose, and just do narrowly based alternative programming, or we could try to become truly public radio and serve the audience in a different way. I think if we have to choose between a small audience and a big audience, we should choose a big audience, but take the risks that go with it.
Jeffrey, so that our listeners understand, the listeners give us the money and we give it to you now.
That's right.
That's right. Just so the laundering process that goes on. Jackie?
George, I wanted to go back to your question about reporters talking to sources, talking. It's very interesting. I found, and Tom Kaczynski and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, but we didn't actually discuss this subject. I found that covering the Montana legislature by not living in Helena is actually saner for me. Because what happens is the legislators ask me, "So what's happening in Billings?" "Well, I've been in Helena for days. I don't know what's happening in Billings. I said, well, you know as well as I do, you open the Billings Gazette or you open the Great Falls Tribune. So I found that the best way to, I mean, for me, there are other factors that go into it, but as I stepped back and sort of analyzed what happened, and for example, in 1999, to go there and be there and then to leave. And then when I would get back to Billings, I would think, you know what? People are taking their kids to school sporting events. They're going shopping. They're not living and breathing this. And I'm thinking, that's really a reality check on the kind of coverage and what I would cover and the way that I would write and the people that I would talk to and so forth, because it becomes a very bizarre situation where you're talking to your sources and they're talking to you and you're only talking to each other. You have no idea what's going on outside of the bubble.
Tom, you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I do. I in fact, that's we were really chewing this at supper this evening. When I said I was loaded for bear, I wanted to talk about the attitudinal thing. I sense that what a lot of the public is reacting to is that they feel that the media disrespects them. And I got to thinking about that in terms of our own newsroom and you know, the kind of education it takes to put out a newspaper or public broadcast and sort of the attitudes that are prevalent in the newsroom. I mean, you know, you talked about the political reporter who you know, whose eyes were opened up by bowling leagues. Well, I mean, you talk about monster truck shows and professional wrestling and stock car racing and bowling, evangelicals, and, you know, any of the things that the average Joe, you know, Montanan goes to, and country music, and you're going to get, you know, nose being held in a lot of the newsrooms. These people look down at these sorts of things. At least that's the sense I get. And I think the people know that, and it comes through in story selection. It comes through when you're out in the public. I mean, I counted on our 34-member staff, I counted 14 master's degrees. That's way out of whack with the average person in Great Falls. Gone are the days, and I'm sure you remember, because I remember when I broke in, you had blue-collar reporters who came up through the ranks. They started as copy persons and clerks, and they learned the job on the job. They were rooted in the community. There wasn't this parachuting in of out of state or out of country reporters who could care less, because it was just a stepping stone as they were moving on somewhere else. And so there was a deep respect, and also the public knew these people, and they could go to them and say, hey, you know, you got this all wrong.
This is Jeffrey Sanders, and I live in Billings and teach at this university. The comment I'd like to make is regarding this recent, almost past general election and the political season. In that, it's interesting the metaphors that are used by the political campaigns for the ground war and the air war, meaning the political ads that come from both the candidate and or soft money from the national campaign or special interest groups, how they can influence the agenda of a local politician by coming in with more money and sort of establishing the agenda or certainly skewing it. And sometimes these soft monies have a tendency to have a little more liberalness with the truth, or stretching things, taking them out of context, or distorting them. What is the media's responsibility when they know that an ad is untrue, taken out of context, to report that back to the public?
Well, a number of news organizations truth squad the political ads, and I think that's quite useful. I think I'm in the minority on this when I say that broadcasters have an obligation to air free time political broadcasts. I know that this has been an issue in public radio recently, because under FCC regulations, the stations should make their have give reasonable access to candidates. And a number of the stations have felt that this is unfair because they're not being able to charge them this, and they don't want their station schedules hijacked really by the politicians. But frankly, I think this is one way to get around the issue of, or to address the issue of campaign finance reform, is that maybe we need to go back to some kind of fairness doctrine, so that since the airwaves are public, that all stations, public and commercial, have an obligation in times of elections to devote a certain amount of airtime in as neutral a way as possible to explore these things. Then in the news, I think news organizations should have a look at the messages that the parties are putting out to determine whether they are accurate or not. And I think that might be a balancing act that would be worth considering.
This is one public station that would go to jail before it would put any commercial on for any candidate, regardless of the FCC rules. However, we're also one of the few stations in the country that had already offered time on the air to every one of these people who contacted us. The Natural Law Party contacted us, saying under these rules and so forth, we're entitled to. We had contacted them repeatedly, asking for time for Dr. John Hagelin to talk to our listeners on the air, and had been ignored. And we asked for his acceptance speech at his convention, a copy of it, and were given a price list by the party. And so we had an answer to the Nader folks, the Natural Law folks, but public radio stations all over the country were scrambling as to what to do. And some of them did run the commercials, which I consider to be an absolute violation of ethics as a broadcaster to do that, well, as a non-commercial broadcaster.
Here's a point where we'll agree to disagree, because I think that it's quite useful to the listener to create a little part of the schedule, say between 5 to 12 and noon, 3 days a week, say under FCC regulations and as a service to the listeners, Yellowstone Public Radio presents these free time political broadcasts, and boom, boom,
yeah,
boom, you just
I agree
roll.
With you. I agree with you. I'm talking about their little soundbite commercials.
Oh, that's
what was running on WAMU that was really bad news.
Right.
Over here.
I'm Bill Ciccone, and Jeffrey, I appreciate your support of serious campaign finance reform, and I also appreciate your mentioning bringing back, resurrecting the fairness doctrine. It's tremendously unfair when local and national talk show hosts attack someone, and then, of course, that person doesn't have a chance to speak to those issues and to protect himself. I also wanted to ask you, what do you think of our willingness, our acceptance of personal attacks, personal serious allegations against a political opponent by saying, well, it's just a part of the political process? Some of those allegations were really abhorrent to me, and I'd like your comment.
Well, here's where I think the lawyers come in handy. If there are issues of libel or slander, rather, then I think that some of these things can be addressed in the courts. But I think broadcasters have an obligation to make sure that comment is fair comment, and that broadcasters can be held to being accountable under a law of third-party libel. I've become terribly expert in these matters in my career, that a broadcaster, if a broadcaster repeats an unsubstantiated allegation that is slanderous, the broadcaster can be held in court as being a party to what's called third-party libel. I don't believe that anyone has the right to defame another person, and I think that there have to be some kind of content, not restrictions, but at least a way of vetting scripts in advance. Otherwise, there would be just an incredible amount of damage done to individual reputations.
Frank Rich in the New York Times, yesterday or today, said we've just come through a campaign in which the two major candidates for president spent a great deal of time and money convincing us that the other candidate was unqualified for the office, unfit for the office, not unqualified, unfit for the office. And we've just come through a campaign for governor of Montana in which the two-party candidates spent a great deal of time and money convincing us that the other candidate was unfit to serve. What does this do for our civics in general to have these things? I would add to that, by the way, which I would suppose criticizes one party more than another. If we are told repeatedly that any tax money spent on anything is bad and that only tax breaks, tax refunds are good, how do we maintain our public institutions? Sorry, Republicans.
Well, there's a lot to answer there. I'm not sure. It's important for me professionally and personally that we reclaim our public spaces intellectually, that there's a place where we can gather to discuss these issues. And that not everything has to have a price on it. Everything has a value, but not everything needs to have a price. And I think that this is something that we can do, that we should be doing and thinking about in the media, which is to say that there are public issues that need reasonable discourse and reasonable discussion. And how can we help achieve those goals, and your obligation to us to tell us when you think that we're doing a good or a less than good job at that. So that's the very simple answer to an incredibly complicated question.
It's interesting, the leadership question, and I'm just going to answer it in terms of the governor's race, because there was not really a whisper campaign, because that makes it sound like there's some sort of a conspiracy, but there were people quietly, I mean, voters and observers and activists, I would say, that were asking about this leadership issue with regard to one of the candidates. And I knew it was out there, I knew that people were talking about it, but I decided early on not to pursue that line, thinking that then somehow I would be driving this sort of agenda. And I waited. And it was not something that I discussed within the station or even with my colleagues. But where I started to actually, we started to ask the questions about it was when the opponent started using it in the ad. Because I didn't want to be perceived as being the attack person or the one that's actually driving that sort of agenda. So I just sat and waited.
Loudmouth pundits on television that you referred to earlier is Chris Matthews, who did say that we thrive on dishonesty in our political campaigns, and that going back to something Jeffrey said, if one network or one newspaper or one station decided not to report the exit polls until the polls were closed, they can't do this because their competition is doing it. It's like Phil Donahue used to say that he did a perfectly respectable talk show for years until somebody on another network came on with a sleaze talk show and he had no audience left. It was gone. I mean, what do you do about that?
Well, I am a great believer in competition. I believe the competition makes us better, but there's a point of diminishing returns as well. And I think we saw it during the impeachment crisis when the New York Times and the Washington Post tried to murder each other journalistically to see who could break that story first. The Post had 50 reporters on that one story. The Times threw in about 60 reporters on that story. And to what effect? There comes a point of deep damage to our ability to function in that public realm. And I worry that one NPR just didn't have the horses to do that that kind of reporting. Although I know there were people, myself included, who thought, "Well, gosh, this is the biggest story. You know, is this our, you know, the story that's going to win us all the Pulitzers?" Anyway, it just became absurd, and we quickly made a virtue out of our lack of resources, and said that we weren't going to do it. It actually, I was driving into work one morning and listening to a 7:30 newscast, and the newscaster said, "Linda Tripp says she's heard all the tapes from Monica Lewinsky, and they're all true." So I go racing into the newsroom and I said, "Where did this come from?" They said, "Oh, Linda Tripp sent us a fax." And she did. She was faxing all of the newsrooms. And I said, "Stop right now. Let's do news the old-fashioned way. We're going to source it. We need two sources for every story." And as a result, we didn't lead that story. Everybody else was putting stuff out there, driven by the internet. Matt Drudge, among others, citing each other, and you know, letting it all settle out over the course of a news cycle. Something, you know, they would retract. I mean, the Dallas Morning News put something out and then retracted it the next day. Nobody. That's an exaggeration. Many journalists who should have known better put stuff on the internet or in their newspapers or on their radio stations that should never have been there. And they lost their minds. I mean, it was, you know, people, what's the Rudyard Kipling poem? If you can keep your head while all about you are losing theirs. People lost their heads all the time, and nobody cared because there are fewer editors to look after it. There are ratings to look after it. Those cable talk shows, I mean, Chris Matthews can do a very good job, but he can also go completely mad, and does, yes.
Tom Ebsery from Billings, question for you, Jeffrey. A couple months ago, we had the open mic episode with George W. Bush, and the couple of words came out major league and big time in describing Adam Clymer. Did you cover that NPR, and if you did, why?
We covered it because, yes, we put that on the radio because I think it was part of the gotcha journalism. It ran, I think, on one cycle and then disappeared. I think that it was worth following at least once, just by virtue of the fact that it happened. Other news organizations ran it again and again and again, which I think was silly and demeaning. And again, you're in this competitive environment. I would really like to see a point at which editors feel confident enough about their sense of mission to their listeners or readers or viewers to say, you know what, we're not going to report this story. It doesn't mean anything. But I don't think NPR felt confident enough in its own mind to step back on that one.
In one of my humble opinions, on your opinion, please, I said that it really enforced the overwhelming male vote that George Bush got because it showed that he was a real man.
You might say that, Marvin. I couldn't possibly comment.
Tonight, before I came here, I was listening, channel surfing through the news stations, and I think it was on, I won't say because I'm not sure, but it was not on Fox News, it was on one of the other big three, and a reporter was interviewing Alan Dershowitz, and
okay, that's on now.
On.
Okay, the battery's dead. We're going to replace the battery.
We'll replace the battery and we'll.
Tonight before I came to this, I was channel surfing through the news and listening, and I came across a reporter interviewing Alan Dershowitz, and he said things about Mrs. Harris, the Secretary of State of Florida. Alan Dershowitz said that she was a thief, that she was corrupt, and on and on and on, just totally slamming her with allegations that weren't provable. And in fact, I found out later that some of the things he was saying were not true. The reporter didn't challenge him on this. He just let it slide. So in effect, what happened, a news story was released that millions of people listened to and probably believed because of all the negative press about her that's been going on again and again and again, just every time you read something. So how can a news organization be respected when this is a continual thing that goes on and on and on and on? I didn't come intending to read this, but I own my own company, so I'm pretty busy. I don't have a lot of time to do this kind of thing. So that's why I rely on the news media to tell me the truth. But just a little bit of time, I dug up this much information on conflicting news articles, and this much here shows me, without a shadow of a doubt, that there's an extreme amount of bias in the press. I wonder what would happen if I spent a week doing this. How big of a stack of paper? This is about a half inch thick of different things over the years. So I guess what I'm saying is what can you do? I know that you three people aren't going to change the world in this, but I appreciate you being here. But what can you do, or what do you think the news media can do to regain my trust so that when I listen to them, I'm hearing the truth and not a biased report or not an allegation, unproved allegation?
Where do you put, I just want you to, I'll give you the mic. Where do you put Rush Limbaugh and the Fox Channel? The Fox Channel says, we report, you decide. Where do you put Bill O'Reilly in that context, since you're talking about bias? I'm just curious.
Well, I treat Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and these types as editorials. So you listen to what they have to say. If it seems right to you, and you know there's other news sources that can verify that. You have to be very selective, though, because a lot of them say the same thing again, which, like you said, they just quote each other, which is no verification of anything. Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, I listen to both of them. I listen to Fox News a lot. I get news off the internet with WorldNet Daily, this type of thing. And I even read the Gazette on the internet. So I get them twice, right? But when you listen to an opinion page, you need to be discerning about it. You can't just believe everything that's said. But if it's a good opinion page, they will prove what they're saying with more than just a quote from another reporter.
I want to tell our technical staff, Guy Moody and Dan Eichlin, that's a way of giving them credit for their help tonight, that we are going to join our next program at 10 minutes after 9. It's now about 3-4 minutes after 9, so we're moving toward the end of this. It's gone very rapidly. Who's next out here?
Thank you. I'm John Havener. Having been sitting here for 2 hours listening to various opinions and questions and probes of these three and until about an hour ago, four people sitting up here, I want to know what you're getting out of this, what we have gotten, the radio audience and the listening audience here in the studio or in the theater. We have gotten a couple hours of information and entertainment. What are you people taking back to your jobs from this two-hour session?
You can think about it.
Well, I'm getting what I think I've been getting for the last 9 months, which is a tremendous sense of how serious you take what we do. And that is really a kind of a humbling demanding aspect of our jobs. I'm grateful that you decided to give up a Saturday night to come and talk with us, and it just reinforces it invigorates my sense of what I do. It also, frankly, I mean, seeing you here in the flesh as opposed to just getting the emails, and although the phone calls can be also quite riveting, is terrific, and I'm really delighted that you're here, and that your concerns and my concerns dovetail, that I'm not actually working in a vacuum. I have one email that I do want to read to you, which I got about a couple of months into the job. And it I read it at moments of, you know, when I'm sort of overwhelmed by the spirit of occasional crankiness that does come through. It's from a Mr. William P. Boyer from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. He said, "Dear Jeffrey, I sincerely feel sorry for you as a person. You have what I think is probably one of the most boring jobs in America. Why? Because NPR gives, without question, the most balanced news coverage in the world. I enjoy the comments, the opinion, the coverage, and the reporting. I find all NPR reporting to be fair, intelligent, complete, balanced, etc. I am a loyal and constant listener and listen on Wisconsin Public Radio." So I answered him and I said, well, I haven't become journalism's Maytag repairman yet. And in fact, I'm up to just under 4,000 emails in 9 months, and they are virtually entirely, there are a few written in crayon metaphorically, but they are mostly very thoughtful and engaged. These are people who believe that NPR can act as an agent of community for them. And that's what you're doing here tonight. You're part of that agency of community, of thoughtful and considered information that you need and you want. So.
For Jackie and Tom, we have about a one-minute opportunity to sum up. It's not because you talk too long, Jeffrey. Go ahead, Jackie.
Well, John, I guess I want to say to you that this is a continuing dialogue that I have had since I started at this station since 1986 and hope to continue. And it is the reason that sometimes I just can't sleep. And when it comes to the point when I don't care what you have to say, and when I frankly don't want to hear it, it's time for me to quit.
I can say that Jackie is frequently more conscientious than her health can keep up with, and we worry about her in that respect. So I urge you to get more sleep. Tom?
Just quickly, continued concern and frustration about our inability to, you know, satisfy, you know, the consumers, the news consumers. And I'm at sort of a loss of what we can do. I think there have been considerable improvements in the professionalism and the product that we put out. But the better we get, the more critical the public becomes. And I'm just not sure what to do about it.
I think that's actually a good thing, that the kind of level of media literacy just gets higher and higher all the time, and it forces us to be better and better all the time. So it's very much a two-way street. I think that's very positive. I'm really encouraged and even more optimistic than I usually am by this evening.
Montana does that to people.
I guess. It's a high altitude.
I want to thank Tom Kotinski from the Great Falls Tribune, Jackie Yamanaka from Yellowstone Public Radio, and Jeffrey Dworkin for being up here in front of all of you tonight. And could we hear a round of applause for... And all of you here in the community group that has participated in this tonight, either as a speaker or as a listener, we really appreciate your coming out and doing this. This was a great success, and we'll have to do it again. Tomorrow morning, Susan DeCamp and I are going to corner Jeffrey in the Channel 7 television studio to talk about the differences between American and Canadian journalism. We're going to tape that, and it'll be on Community 7 at some point in the future. And I think for you who live in the Billings area, that will be interesting to hear his comments on that, because he didn't have much chance to talk about it tonight. He's going on tomorrow to Missoula, where he'll spend part of the day on Monday with journalism students at the University of Montana before he goes back to Washington. That's it for tonight. Thanks to everybody who participated.
Very nice to meet you.
This is a Yellowstone Public Radio station. KEMC Billings, KBMC Bozeman, KECC Miles City, KNMC Havre, and KYPR Gillette.